Pesach approaching, what I wanted to do, you know, every year we try to take a different approach to Pesach. We discussed matzah before, discussed chametz before, we discussed a lot of things. So whether you remember it or not, I like this to be different. So we could always repeat and people might, you know, it's good for it to review, but I want to do this a little different this year. So what I want to do right now is two things. I want to first just give an introduction to the Haggadah in general, the Seder in general. And then number two, I want to try to go through line by line certain parts of the Haggadah. We'll see this week and next week, we'll see what we can cover. It's important to understand that the Seder is a very organized ritual. Seder means order. That's the word Seder means. And it is an order that the rabbis gave to us to perform the mitzvahs of the night. There are five mitzvahs of Pesach night that every Jew is obligated to do. Two of those mitzvahs are biblical and three rabbinic. The two biblical mitzvahs we have on the Seder night are to eat matzah and to tell the story of the Exodus. And we have three rabbinic mitzvahs. The rabbinic mitzvahs are eating the maror, the bitter herbs, the rabbinic mitzvah, saying the hallel, and the four cups of wine. So those are our five mitzvahs to accomplish at night. Two of the biblical origin, three rabbinic origin. In the times of the temple, is also eating the Paschal lamb, the Korban Pesach. And when we ate the Korban Pesach, there's a biblical mitzvah as well to eat the bitter herbs that went together with the Korban Pesach. Nowadays, we don't eat the offering of the Korban, so that's not even part of our night. We remember it through the Afikom, and we don't actually eat the Korban itself. And the bitter herbs have been downgraded to rabbinic obligation. Those are our goals for the night. The Seder, the order of the Seder, is the structure through which the rabbis gave to us to set up the night. So we have five mitzvahs to accomplish. They have to be accomplished in a certain way, in a certain order. So we have a Haggadah, which tells us every single step of how we're supposed to go about accomplishing the mitzvahs of the night. So it's a very organized, you know, regimen to accomplish these mitzvahs. It has to be done a certain way. The four cups of wine, you can't just drink them one after the other. If you sat down and took four shots of wine, you haven't done your mitzvah. It has to be done within the structure of the Haggadah. First one being Kiddush, second one being after telling the story, third one being after benching, the fourth one being after the Hallel. It has to be done that way. If you do it out of order, you haven't done your mitzvah. So, and all the mitzvahs are done in this order for a reason. So it's important to understand that. The Haggadah has 15 steps. Kadesh, Orchatz, Karpas, Yachatz, those are the 15 steps of the Haggadah. And 15 is a significant number in that there were 15 steps going from the outer courtyard to the inner courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash. If you entered into the Temple Mount, so there was an outer courtyard, and then you'd go 15 steps into the inner courtyard. Welcome. There's a seat over here, if we can somehow get someone in.
The table here.
That'd be easier.
There you go. Okay, good. Yeah, all right, full house today. Look at this. Yeah. People just like pizza. So the weather, right, for us all out. Good. So these 15 steps are symbolic of those 15 steps that went from the outer courtyard to the inner courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash, which means for us that there is an elevation which we're supposed to be going through during the Pesach Seder. 15 also is a numerical value of one of the names of God, the name of Yud and Hey, Yah. That name of God has the gematria of 15, because 15 is a significant number. If you look through Dayenu, those are 15 steps in Dayenu. It might be recorded also.
Is that okay?
That's fine. Yeah.
No, I'm
recorded here as well.
Dayenu is 14.
I think it's 15. You have your Haggadah. You count for us.
It goes for me. This is, I will tell you. I don't.
You can tell us, yeah. But this,
no.
To my knowledge, maybe Sarah will correct me, but there are 15 steps of.
One. Okay.
You numbered them.
No, but because I did my own day. Therefore, I was pretty. It was
she important. Had enough for 14.
The 15th one is. This in the second half of the last statement, though, and the book, the Beis HaMikdash, is number 15. If you count the 15 occurrences in the Yenu, it's only in 14 lines, the 15 different things that we discussed.
Okay, thank you. I will get another
one. Good. So that's the significance of 15. So you have 15 steps in your Seder, which is supposed to elevate us, bring us closer to God. We should leave the Seder feeling accomplished. Accomplished both in terms of performing our five mitzvahs of the Seder and accomplished through our elevated state, you know, feeling more connected to God after the Seder. So that's the basic structure of the Haggadah. So the Haggadah, if you look through it carefully, is very structured, and it's in order to give us a structure through which to perform these five mitzvahs. The one of the central mitzvahs, which takes up, I guess, the most time of our night, is to tell the story of the Exodus. that is a major focus of the night of the Seder, and that is a Torah obligation to tell the story of the Exodus on the night of the Seder. That mitzvah is in contrast to a daily mitzvah we have every single day. There's a mitzvah twice daily, morning and night, to remember the Exodus. We have a mitzvah every single morning, and every night to mention the Exodus in some way. It's actually built into the Shema. The last paragraph of the Shema, it says, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I am Hashem, your God, Asher Tzeisiyeschem Eretz Mitzrayim, that took you out of the land of Egypt, V'yos Lachem Elokeichem, to be your God. So the rabbis built into our obligation of the daily Shema, they put that paragraph in also to remember the Exodus. Because we have an obligation day and night to remember the Exodus. So the commentaries discuss the distinction between what's our additional obligation on the night of the Seder, versus our obligation we have daily of the Exodus. So there's many distinctions. One of those being that we have to do it in front of the matzah and the maror. There is a halacha. You're obligated to have our conversation pieces in front of us, our matzah and our maror, our Seder plate. And that's part of what we do. We don't need that daily, but we need that at the Seder night. There is a concept called maschil beganus masayim b'shvach, which means the way we tell the story has to begin with the negative parts of our history and move towards the positive. So the Gemara has a dispute over what that means. The great sage Rav says that the genus, the negative aspect of our history we start with, is the fact that our original ancestors were idolaters. They worshipped idols. Abraham's father, Terach, was an idol worshipper. He owned an idol store. And we move from that all the way to the point that we say, now God has brought us close to His service. That we've moved away from idolatry towards monotheism. And that's how, and so Rav says that should be the theme of our story on the night of the Seder. The move from idolatry towards monotheism. Shmuel, the great sage Shmuel in the Gemara, he says that the genus that we're discussing, the negative part of our history that we discuss, is the idea that we were slaves. Simply, we were slaves, and now we're free. So there's two themes which cover the Haggadah. One theme is our spiritual liberation. We used to be idolaters, and now we are believers in God. And that's a theme of the Haggadah, which is our spiritual liberation. Then there's our physical freedom, the fact that we used to be slaves, and now we're free. And those are both themes that run through the Haggadah. But we're obligated to begin with our negative parts of our history and move towards the positive. That's part of our obligation at the Seder night. Whereas our daily obligation is just to mention God took us out of Egypt, period. We don't have to mention anything about slavery, we don't have to mention anything about being idolaters, we just say we were taken out of Egypt. So that's one major distinction we have. Right, yeah, both themes are part of the Haggadah, and both of these are in the Haggadah. Now, unfortunately, you know, I had a whole stack of Haggadahs I saved for giving classes, and I couldn't find them this morning in my house, so thank you. Yeah, this morning I looked over my entire house, and I couldn't find my stack of Haggadahs I saved.
You didn't clean enough.
I guess not.
You didn't clean too much.
One or the other. Because I keep them separate from my Pesach box, because I'm bringing them into the bagel place, so I'm not going to have them at my Pesach table, you know? So, I wanted to keep them separate in a bag, I couldn't find the bag. But in the Haggadah, you have both themes. So we do have a paragraph which says, Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves in Egypt, and God took us out of Egypt, and then we tell the story of the Exodus. And we also have a paragraph which says, Midchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Yavlaseinu, initially our ancestors were idolaters, V'achshav Kirvanu Makom Avdaso, now God has brought us close to His service. So both themes are mentioned in the Haggadah, and our job is to understand that both of these were kind of simultaneous processes happening during the Exodus. We were getting a physical freedom. We were in hard labor for 2 centuries, and we were freed by God miraculously. But also, we were attaining a spiritual freedom. That originally, we were bound to idolatry, to the world, to paganism, and then we were able to be liberated to serve the one and only God. And that was the two different processes which we're supposed to experience and feel gratitude for during the Seder, during the night of the Seder, when we retell the story of the Exodus. Another aspect of the story of the night of the Seder, in contrast to our daily obligation, is, so we mentioned you have to have the matzah in front of you, we mentioned you have to start with negative parts of history and then move towards the positive. Another aspect of it is they're supposed to do it in a question and answer form, which we all know the manishtana, where the kids ask the questions, but it's not just kids. There's an obligation for adults also to ask questions. And if there's no kid at your Seder table, adults ask the questions to one another. Because we have to do it in a question and answer form. That's an obligation quoted in, you know, based on the Talmud, quoted by the Rambam, that we have to do it in a question and answer form. Our daily obligation is just, again, to recite, God took me out of Egypt. That's all we have to do on a daily basis. But the Seder is a question and answer form. And the piece I want to discuss at length is his other idea, which is that the way that we tell the story is not just telling a story, but if you look at your Haggadah, so I'll take a look over here, we base it on a section in the Torah, and we expound upon that section of the Torah. In Parshas Kisavo, in the book of Devarim, front page over here, we discussed the mitzvah of Bikurim, bringing the first fruits. There's an obligation on farmers in Israel in the times of the temple that they would bring their first fruits to the temple as offering to the Kohanim, and that was an obligation for every Jewish farmer in the times of the temple. And when the farmers would bring their fruits to Yerushalayim to give it to the Kohanim, they would have a special recitation to say. And that recitation is basically a recap of Jewish history, showing their gratitude that you freed me from Egypt, you performed miracles for me, you brought me to Mount Sinai, gave me the Torah, and brought me to my piece of land here in the land of Israel. And thank you so much for allowing my crops to succeed this year, and now I'm presenting to the Kohanim my first fruits. That's that recitation you have in the book of Devarim. So we take that paragraph, and the Haggadah then goes at length to expound upon every single phrase of that paragraph. So it says, if you don't mind, my bag, I have, that's my bag, 1 second, and I just want to get out the folder so I can read the full quote to you. Thank you, I'm sorry. Okay, let me send it back. Thank you very much. It's hard to know, God, it's hard to pull out the entire quote, so I'll pull it out to you from here. It says that you should, when you bring your first fruits, you should recite before Hashem your God, Arami Oved Avi, in Aramean, which according to most commentaries refers to Lavan, the uncle of Yaakov, the brother of Rivka, tried to destroy my father. Lavan in the Torah tries to kill, eliminate Yaakov. And he went down to Egypt, V'yagar Sham V'Simat, and he lived there, few in number. And he became there a great nation, strong and many. And the Egyptians did evil to us, and they oppressed us, and they enslaved us. They gave us very hard work. We called out to Hashem, the God of our fathers, and He listened to our voice, and He saw our oppression, and our hard work, and our pressure. And He took us out of Egypt with a strong hand and outstretched arm, and with great terror, and with great miracles, and brought us to this place, the land of Israel, and gave us this land flowing with milk and honey. And now here I am, bringing my first fruits, which You gave to me, God, and I'm placing them before You, and I'm bowing down before You. So that's the recitation a person says they bring their first fruits. So the obligation of the Haggadah is to take that recitation and expound upon the section that discusses the Exodus. Now, that means for us, why is it that we take... I mean, we have an entire... two or three entire parshas back in the book of Shmos discussing the Exodus. If you look at Parshas Shmos, Va'era, Bo, and also Vishalah, really it's four parshas which discuss the story of the Exodus. But yet we jump all the way to the end of the Torah, in the book of Devarim, and we, at our Seder, discuss this paragraph in the book of Devarim. Why is that? Because seemingly this paragraph is a summary of the story, but the summary of the story of the Exodus includes within it every single essential point we need to know about the Exodus. So in the book of Shmos, you have the long, complete story. But we're not going to tell the entire story. We don't have enough time one night to go through all four parshas in the book of Shmos. So rather, we take what is the essence of the story, the summary, which is found in the book of Devarim, Parshas Kisavo, and we expound upon all the points there. And that means that everything we see in this paragraph, which we're going to expound upon, those are the essential points to know about the Exodus. I mean, there's a lot of other information which is not there, but all the other information is secondary. The essence of the story is going to be summarized in this paragraph that we quote in the Haggadah at the Seder. So...
where is this in the Haggadah?
Well, the Haggadah begins, I mean, in the order of the Haggadah, it's in Magid. You have the four sons. After that, we discuss, we were originally idolaters. We have the Hisha Amda, which we raise up our cups. And then right after that, it says, go out and learn what Lavan, the Aramean, tried to do to our father. From there on, we start expounding upon that paragraph. And that really takes us all the way through the 10 plagues in the Haggadah. And this, the Mishnah says, is the basic way to tell the story. The Mishnah tells us that this is the way we're supposed to relate the story of the Exodus at our Seders. That's what the Mishnah says. So these paragraphs should be the essence of it. Everything we sense in this paragraph should be what we need to know at the Seder. So then what I want to do is, right now, I want to try to go through line by line this paragraph and understand what the Haggadah is trying to teach us with that paragraph. The Haggadah is not an easy book. It's hard to navigate. You know, we expect that if the rabbis tell us to tell a story of the Exodus, they'll sit down and give us a storybook. We all know, if we've seen the Haggadah, it's not that way. The Haggadah seems to be kind of disconnected. The story is not clearly how Haggadah tells it. I mean, we all know about the 10 plagues. That part's pretty clear. But besides that, the Haggadah is a difficult book to understand. Because what the Haggadah is trying to do, it's not trying to be a storybook. It's trying to give us the essential points to understand about the divine providence involved in the Exodus, the points to understand that we have to bring home to ourselves at the Seder. So it's not just telling a story. We should tell the story as well at our Seders. The Haggadah is supposed to be an outline to give you a kind of a key entrance into the emotional and the essential points, both in divine providence, in Jewish thought, in emotion, which should impact us at the Seder. So we have to take each line, you know, piece by piece, and understand the message of it. So because I couldn't find my Haggadah, I did make some copies. Thank God we have a large crowd today, so I don't have enough copies, but we can share. I'll give you yours back, because I have one of these. You can use your own Haggadah. And we'll try to get through at least the beginning part of this paragraph today, and then maybe next week we'll do some more. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can share. So yeah, there's probably only about 5 or 6 in the stack. So. Yeah. I apologize for the shortage of copies. But. Okay. If I find my Haggadahs for next week, I'll bring those in too. Everyone can bring their Haggadah next week if they want.
If you want Maxwell House, I'll bring some.
Yeah, perfect. That's what I have also is Maxwell House. I picked a bunch of a giant. Yeah, that's right. So on the bottom of page 65 in the copy I handed out, it's kind of in the middle of the Haggadah, and now we're getting into what is the essence of telling the story. Until this point in the Haggadah, it's all introductory material. The idea of the four sons talks about, you know, maybe we should have started telling the story at Rosh Chodesh. I mean, there's a lot of paragraphs in the Gada which are all introduction. But now we're at the essence of the story. And it begins over here on the bottom of page 65. And this is now going to take this paragraph found in Parshas Kisavo and take it phrase by phrase and develop what each phrase is trying to teach us. So let's start. If you look at the bottom, it's the fourth line in that paragraph. And it quotes, it's the first verse quoted from the section we discussed. It says, "An Aramean sought to destroy my father." So Lavan, who was from the land of Aram, an Aramean, he sought to destroy my father, Yaakov. He descended to Egypt. So Yaakov then went down to Egypt and sojourned there with a small number of people. There he became a nation, great, powerful, and populous. So that's the beginning of this recitation that a person would say when they bring their first fruits. So we're going to now take this summary of the story piece by piece. This first verse describes the Jews descending to Egypt and describes their existence there before slavery and also during slavery. When they were there, they came down as a small number of people, as we'll discuss in a minute, and they grew in leaps and bounds in Egypt. I mean, they were only there for 210 years. They came down, we'll see in a second, with 70 people. And they left with 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60. If you do your math, add in the women, the children, the seniors, and the children, and everyone else, so you end up with probably close to 3-4 million people leaving Egypt. So from 70 to 3 million in a matter of 200 years is a pretty impressive growth rate. Yes?
The amount of Egypt and how many people were
70 went into Egypt.
In the
oh, yeah. So the rabbis say also that it could be that even 4/5 of Jews died in the plagues. Well, if 3 million left and 4/5 died, that'd be 12 million. I mean, they had 15 million. 4/5 of them were killed in the plagues. So let's discuss that. I'll discuss that in a second. It's a good question. So now the Haggadah continues. It takes each phrase of this paragraph. He descended to Egypt. So what does it mean he descended to Egypt? And keep in mind that he descended to Egypt is a quote from the Torah. And now the Haggadah expounds upon that. Compelled by God's decree, the Yaakov is descended to Egypt compelled by God's decree. So the Haggadah is telling us that Yaakov going to Egypt wasn't just happenstance. He just happened to end up in Egypt. I mean, the sale of Joseph brought him to Egypt. That's what brought him down there, as we know. And Joseph was sold and ended up as the second in command in Egypt, and Yaakov wanted to go down and see his son when he found out his son was still alive. But nothing is coincidence. God has a plan. and God orchestrated it that that would happen. Where did this all come from? How do we know that God orchestrated this entire event? Because God already told Abraham, when God made a covenant with Abraham, God told Abraham that, you know, you're going to be the father of a great nation, I'm going to give you the land of Israel, but for 400 years, you're going to be oppressed. Your children are going to be in a foreign land, they're going to have to work, they're going to be oppressed, but after that, I'm going to save them miraculously and bring them out with great wealth. That's what God tells Abraham. So Hashem already had predetermined that the Jews will be enslaved in a foreign land, and therefore when Yaakov ended up in Egypt, he didn't just end up there, he was brought there based on divine providence. Now God tells us this is all part of God's plan. He was compelled by God's decree to remain there in Egypt. The great commentary, the Maharal, describes, let's say there was no decree, you have to go be enslaved, and Yaakov just ended up there in Egypt, and God still saved us miraculously. Would that have made a big difference? The fact that Yaakov ended up there based on the divine decree versus, let's say Yaakov just decided, I'm going to move to Egypt today. And then the same story unfolded and they were enslaved and God saved us with 10 plagues. Would things have really been different? So the Maharal says yes. Because God jumping in after the fact doesn't show there's a divine plan at play here. It shows that God saw his people being oppressed and God had to jump in and save them. The fact that God is the one who decreed we should go to Egypt, God's the one who decreed the slavery, and God's the one who saved us, shows it's all part of a divine plan. It wasn't just God coming in as a superhero and taking us out of oppression. It was all part of the plan of history, starting with Abraham, moving all the way through this very day. But if it just happened to be we were in trouble and God happened to come in and save us, so then that wouldn't have shown that it was part of any divine plan. It would just show that God wants to be our superhero and come save us. That's what we would have seen. So it's very important. This is all based on the covenant with Abraham. This would happen. And therefore, this shows this is the greatness of the divine plan. The slavery itself is part of the divine plan. Now we can all ask, well, why was that part of the plan? Right? Why was it that part of the divine plan for the chosen people was that we should be enslaved in Egypt? So that's a very difficult question. It's discussed by many, many commentaries as to why that may be. I guess we can throw out one answer, but there's many answers to this question. And again, we don't know. We never know 100% what God's plan is, that we can never answer the question fully. But at least we can suggest answers, and the great commentators suggest answers to the question. Why does this have to be part of the plan? So one simple answer is that the Jews have to learn what it means to be servants. If we're going to be servants of God, we have to have experienced absolute servitude. Because ultimately, as a servant of God, we also have to be. Oh, I'm sorry. You want to move a little closer? Maybe the table closer? Move closer if you want. Move back, but the question was, why is it part of the divine plan that we have to go to Egypt? That was the question, right? So one answer given is that the Jews had to learn how to be servants. That was life as a Jew. We're called Avdei Hashem, servants of God. And if we didn't have in our blood the ability to subjugate ourselves totally to another power, so then we couldn't subjugate ourselves to God. And because it's in our blood, it's in our genes now, that we are servants at heart, because we spent generations and generations in slavery, so we were able to go to Mount Sinai and commit ourselves as God's servants for the rest of eternity. Yes. So that's one answer given. Other answers given as well. That's one answer we can take away and understand. That's part of the idea of the servitude in Egypt. The Haggadah then continues. He sojourned there. Sojourn there is part of the verse, quote. And Haggadah then says, this teaches us that our patriarch Jacob did not go down to Egypt intending to settle there, but merely to sojourn there. As it says, and they, Jacob's sons, told Pharaoh, we have come to sojourn in this land, for there is no pasture for the flocks of your servants, because the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen. This is a very important point. When Yaakov came down to Egypt, Yaakov was not personally intending to stay there for very long. He wanted to go see his son, Yosef. There was a famine now in the land of Israel, so he had to go and get food.
He didn't know that his son was there.
When he went down, he knew. By that time, he knew.
Oh, yeah.
That's when he decided to go down. He already was aware that Yosef was there. And they needed food. There was nowhere to pasture their flocks. Yaakov was a shepherd. That's how they made their living. There's no more grass to eat in the land of Canaan. There was such a famine. There was a drought, and nothing was growing anymore. So he went down to Egypt for a temporary stay. Now, why is this an important part? And that's the verse. The verse says, La Gorsham, to sojourn there. He didn't go to live there. He went to sojourn there. He was there on a temporary a hiatus. That's what he was doing there. But he wasn't actually there for the long term. Why is that important? Why is that important in the story of the Exodus? So, the Maharal, he describes that if Yaakov went down there in order to become part of Egypt, in order to live there, in order to be assimilated into Egyptian society, there would be nothing left to redeem. When God came to redeem the Jews, there wouldn't be a single Jew left. Because the attitude is, I'm now going to go into Egypt and I'm going to become Egyptian. So then, what distinguishes the children of Yaakov from the other Egyptians that are there? God's coming in to save his people with whom he made a covenant. But if we totally assimilated into Egyptian society, so then there wouldn't be a single person of the covenant left because they'd all be Egyptian at this point. Even as it was, they sunk down in their levels of spirituality. They did worship idols in Egypt. I mean, even as it was, it wasn't pretty. It was a very difficult time for the Jews. However, since the attitude was, we're only here as visitors, we're not here permanently, so they still maintained their own identity. They remained separate, they remained defined as Jews. This allowed them to avoid assimilation, hold on to the roots they had in the patriarchs, you know, to their heritage as the children of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. But had they gone down, we are now moving into Egypt to be Egyptian, so then, unfortunately, they could have been lost into oblivion. I mean, we've seen it. Unfortunately, you look at Jews that came over from Europe in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s into America. So those Jews who came over and saying, we are now Americans. So many of them are no longer Jews. You don't see their children, their grandchildren aren't Jewish anymore. Unfortunately, we see that. We've experienced it. We've seen it. Those Jews who came over holding on to their faith, so they're the ones who had a chance of remaining Jewish. But those Jews, you know, the unfortunate old quote is that they tossed their tefillin over at Ellis Island into the Atlantic. I mean, that is a reality for many, many families that came over from Europe to America in the 30s and 40s. They assimilated into the great melting pot of America, and there's not a Jew left of those families. Those who came over to America holding on to their faith and maintaining their traditions, so even though many families still ended up assimilating to some degree, usually those are the families that still identify as Jews and have, you know, observant Jewish, you know, descendants. But so the Jews who went down into Egypt, if they're going there to become Egyptians, so then that would have been it. You know, given a few generations, they would have forgotten about Yaakov, forgotten about Yitzchak, and they would have been just like any other Egyptian on the street. Because they went down the attitude, we're only here as visitors, but we're not here to become Egyptian. So that's why there was something left of Jewish identity 200 years later when God came to redeem them and sent Moshe to redeem them. The sad thing is that throughout history, ever since then also, we've seen the same thing happen over and over again. Whenever Jews start deciding we're going to assimilate into our host countries, so that's usually when God has to come in and tell us, don't think you can become non-Jewish at this point. I mean, when Jews were in Egypt, that was before they ever got the Torah. So at that point, this would have been over. Now we got the Torah, and God says, you're an eternal people. If you try to assimilate, I'm going to make sure that country makes you know that you're Jewish. And we've seen it over and over again. If you look at Jewish history, usually when the worst tragedies of Jewish history occurred, it's usually after the worst assimilation occurred. You know, Hitler, he took Jews even who had one Jewish grandparent. They themselves would halakhically be Germans. They wouldn't have been Jewish. They would have been Christians. But you have one Jewish grandparent, you're also going to concentration camps. You know, Jews can't get away from it. But once you're Jewish, you remain Jewish.
So you're saying tragedy followed assimilation?
If you look, there's definitely a pattern in history that way. Because the tragedy is trying to show you think you can assimilate and become like the non-Jews, they're still going to hate you. You know, if you try to be Jewish, they're going to respect you. If you try to act like them, they're still going to treat you as Jews. They're going to treat you not nicely as Jews.
But even in Egypt, we were slaves. Even the people, the Jews who tried to assimilate, wouldn't they still have been considered slaves and different? They would never have been accepted. Would they have ever been accepted as an Egyptian?
You know, that's a good question. Had they not clung to their roots, it could be the Egyptians wouldn't have enslaved them. Pharaoh felt threatened by them. Because this is a nation which they claim to be their own people, and they're growing in leaps and bounds, and they're going to take over Egypt. That's what he was worried about. If they said we're Egyptians, then he wouldn't have been threatened. You know, you could definitely argue something like that. And then he wouldn't have been enslaved. I mean, I don't know what would have happened. I haven't seen commentaries discuss that point. But Pharaoh felt threatened by the Jews, because this is a nation which claims that they're the nation of God. They claim that they're a special nation. Their numbers are multiplying, you know, in an amazing rate. And they're going to take over our land if I don't do something about it. So that's why he enslaved us. So it's a question we can't know the answer to. But that's what the commentaries describe. How God is telling us they went down into Egypt in order to only be there as visitors, not to become Egyptian. And that's why there was an ability to redeem them at the end because they still held on to their Jewish identity. And we'll describe that more in a minute in another line of Haggadah. Just to move on, and just one other point. It says that they requested to live in the land of Goshen. The land of Goshen was like a suburb in Egypt. And the commentary, the Rashbats, he describes that the reason they asked for that land, the land of Goshen, I mean, it was a good place for pasture, which is one point the Torah tells us, but also, geographically, it was the closest area in Egypt to the land of Israel. Because they felt that we want to still maintain our ties to Israel. We're only here temporarily. We want to be as close as we can to Israel as possible. Sinai, I guess it may have been like somewhere towards like the Sinai desert, or so, I don't know, but somewhere, it was the closest part of like the settled Egypt to Israel. And therefore, they chose that land so they could maintain their ties to Israel even when they were in Egypt. But that helped them to hold on to their identity, not assimilate. Now, Gana then continues, they were there in very small number. As it says, your ancestors went down to Egypt with 70 individuals. Now God has made you as numerous as the stars of the sky. So this is what we discussed. There was an incredible birth rate in Egypt. And again, in four generations, they went from 70 to millions and millions. Again, there are different records of how much, in rabbinic sources, there are different records of how many Jews there actually were at the time. But the Torah tells us there were at least 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60. So working from that, you end up with millions as is, and assuming many died in slavery, died during the plagues, there are a lot more that didn't make it. So there was a tremendous growth of the Jews in Egypt. Why is that important for us to know? So number one, that they became so great and powerful that Pharaoh felt threatened by us. Because look, you know, these 70 people aren't so threatening. But when they increased to millions, Paro felt very, very threatened.
Excuse me, Rabbi.
Yes.
I'm not picking on the word men. You said 600,000 men. Did you really mean men?
Yeah, I meant men. Right.
You really did.
The Torah says 600,000 means the men. So you add in the women, and that's men between 20 and 60. So that's how many men between 20 and 60 there were at the Exodus, 600,000 men. So you add in women, you add in children, and you add in senior citizens, so then you end up with a lot more.
Wow.
Yeah. So the numbers, it was very large numbers that left Egypt, starting at 70. They became so powerful so fast that these 70 people posed a threat to Paro. It's an incredible thing. It's just picture that a nomadic tribe from Mexico, 7 people, enters into Arizona. And the fact that the U.S. would feel threatened by this tribe is ridiculous. Because it's 70 people. You know, the U.S. is one of the most powerful governments in the world. You know, Egypt was the world empire at the time. 70 Jews, nomadic Jews from Canaan came down into Egypt. And Paro felt a threat from them. Why? Because his numbers were increasing so fast, he couldn't do anything about it. And they started to feel that was part of the miracle and the divine providence involved in this slavery. Or else it wouldn't have been a threat. Okay, big deal, 70 people, what are they going to do to me? I have an army of millions. But Paro said, look how fast and powerful, look how they're increasing. Commentaries even point out, the rabbis tell us that the women gave birth to 6 babies at a time, some say even 60 at a time. It could be an exaggeration, but I mean, they had a tremendous birth rate.
6 back then was different than 6 now.
Yeah, that's true too.
The
60, yeah, some say, there's an opinion that say 60. But the point is, it was a tremendous birth rate. Even those people who naturally could not have given birth, they conceived, women who were past the age of bearing children, women who physically could not bear children, they were able to bear children in Egypt. People remained healthy, the babies remained healthy. I mean, it was just a tremendous, tremendous rate. We'll discuss that more in a minute, but the growth rate was incredible. As we can see, the numbers in those four generations going from 70 to millions. The Haggadah continues. There he became a nation. This teaches that Israel became distinct there. So we became referred to as a nation now. We came down as a family. It was Yaakov and his children and grandchildren when they came down into Egypt. Now they became a nation. So it says that they became distinct in Egypt. So a simple understanding is that they actually took on the qualities of a nation rather than a family. You know, a family is, you know, they have a house, and they have a few houses together in a neighborhood, and they meet each other for meals, and you know, and they enjoy simples together. But they took on the qualities of a nation in Egypt. That they really, it was a huge number of people that all bonded together with one goal, one culture, you know, feeling allegiance to one God. And the rabbis tell us further that they actually were distinct in how they acted. They were distinct in their language. They continued speaking Hebrew in Egypt. they maintained their Jewish names. So they didn't take on the Egyptian names, they maintained their Jewish names. And that's how they remained distinct in Egypt. There are sources that say they maintained their Jewish clothing. Not sure how they dressed back then, but I guess there was a Jewish mode of clothing which they maintained as well, according to some commentaries. They avoided speaking Lashon Hara, the rabbis tell us. And also, they were very moral. Adultery was not part of Jewish culture as it was in the Egyptian culture. Incestual relationships the Jews did not involve themselves in, where the Egyptians did. So, you know, a Jew in the office, you know, in Egypt, quote unquote, he was very distinct. Everyone knew he was Jewish. There was a clear Jewish identity there, based on the name and the language and the way they acted. They acted differently, and they remained distinct. This is part of the fact they did not assimilate. If not, had they assimilated again, they would have been lost into oblivion, and they wouldn't have been any piece of the patriarchs left within them. The whole culture and the legacy passed on from Abraham and Yaakov would have been totally lost. But the Jews in Egypt remained distinct in many ways, and they became a distinct nation. They kept that identity. They were clearly Jewish. The next part describes Gadol Atzum. They were great and powerful. As it is written, children of Israel were fruitful, became prolific, multiplied, and became very, very powerful. The land became full with them. So it seems redundant at first. They were fruitful, prolific, multiplied, and powerful. So we have to understand what each term is describing. This is a quote from the Torah. So the Torah is not redundant. Each word is describing something different. So what is each term here describing? So the commentary is described, I'm quoting for you from the commentary called Yad Mitzrayim, written by Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Chaver, who was a great commentator probably in the 1800s. He writes that the idea of being fruitful refers to this point that even people who could not physically bear children were able to bear children in Egypt. That was the idea of being fruitful. When it says that they were prolific, so this is the concept that they gave birth to multiple children at once, as we said, maybe 6 at a time, maybe 60 at a time, but it was multiple childbirths at once. They didn't just give birth to one baby at a time. The next term used is multiplied. So this commentary explains that often when women are pregnant and they give birth, so it takes the recovery, usually is a long recovery, women are weak, and it's very difficult to constantly give birth to more and more babies, you know, within a limited period of time. In Egypt, they were giving birth to many babies very often. Women did not feel weak, tired, or drained from the pregnancies or from the labor or from the recovery. The women maintained their strength, able to constantly give birth to more and more babies, despite the fact that it was so close in time to the previous pregnancy. So that's the miracle of Vayirgu, that they were multiplied. And it says they're very, very powerful. The children, usually when children are born from, you know, twins, triplets, the children usually are smaller or weaker when they're born. If you can imagine 6 at a time or 60 at a time, so probably those children would be quite weak when they were born. The children were born very healthy and strong. That's what the rabbis tell us. It's part of the miracle of the great birth rate in Egypt. The children were all born healthy and strong, despite the numbers of babies born at a time. And then when it says the term very, very powerful refers to the fact that this became well known by the Egyptians. The Egyptians saw this, and this is spreading across the land. So that's why Paro felt threatened, because he saw, look at these people. They're going to take over very soon. There's millions of them. What am I supposed to do? So he enslaved them in order to stop them from rebelling. But if you stop and think about it, it's an amazing concept to dwell upon for a second. The Jews must have felt God's hand in their lives. They were enslaved in very, very bitter, difficult slavery, very difficult work. And if you read the descriptions of the rabbis of their jobs, it was horrific. I mean, it was dangerous. They didn't sleep. They couldn't eat. They were tortured. It was horrible. But simultaneous to them feeling that torture from the slavery, they also saw God's miracles. They saw their wives, they saw their children, they were healthy, they were strong, they saw this birth rate, which was enormous. Obviously, it's miraculous. So that gave them a glimmer of hope throughout the entire time they were in Egypt. What helped them hang on to their roots and hang on to who they were? It's because they saw that God's divine hand was there every step of the way. They didn't really know what was happening. They couldn't figure out, but certainly when there's 6 babies being born at a time, and everyone's healthy and strong, and they saw these miracles happening left and right. Even this is well before the 10 plagues. So this gave them a glimmer of hope. We understand this part of the divine plan. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know how long it's going to be. We know that we're heading somewhere. And that, I assume, gave them some encouragement. It was kind of an empowering feeling for them. So they saw that divine plan. So that's what's described by great and powerful. But for us, they'll pull out the Haggadah as well. We have to see that the miracles which occur in Egypt. God put us there to become a nation. So God had to make sure that we develop the numbers of a nation, and God had to make sure that we maintained our identity. So the Haggadah is describing to us that we did not assimilate, maintained our identity. God miraculously provided for us a tremendous rate of growth, and even though we were enslaved in a terrible manner, but we, the entire time, we were able to perceive the divine hand involved, and that kept us going throughout the entire slavery. Let's do one more section before we end here, this last section. It says, Varav and Populous, as it is written. This to me is one of the most difficult paragraphs to understand the connection between the word populous and then the verse it's about to quote. So let's learn through it together. It says, and populous as it is written, people became populous as it says, I made you as numerous as the plants of the field. You grew and developed, becoming very beautiful. Your breasts firm and your hair grown long, but you were naked and bare. I passed over you and saw you weltering in your blood. And I said to you, through your blood you will live. And I said to you, through your blood you will live. And that repetition is actually intentional there, not a typo. It's supposed to be repeated twice. So every time we see this format in the Haggadah, the first word, again, is a quote from this paragraph we discussed in the Book of Devarim. And then this is the Haggadah expounding upon it. So the Haggadah is trying to somehow quote for us the meaning of the concept of what it means to be populous from this next quote about the plants of the field growing and developing. It doesn't seem to connect. What exactly is the connection here? So first, you know, in English translation, you always lose a lot because it already translates for us the word Rav as populous. The Haggadah is not doing that right now. The Haggadah is trying to translate the word differently, it seems, if you look into the Hebrew. When it says, that the verse in Hebrew reads, Revava ketzema chasada, you have sprouted forth like the plants of the field. Because saying that the concept of Rav is not, does not mean the idea of populous. We already mentioned we became populous. It means that we were compared to plants. We're sprouting forth like plants. What's that metaphor, sprouting forth like plants? So there's a number of ways it's taken in the different commentaries. But first, it's important to understand that Jews were like seeds in Egypt. Meaning that when you plant a seed in the ground, what happens? At first, it's going to kind of decay, fall apart, and then the sprouts start coming out of the ground. The Jews in Egypt, this is our period of being planted. The Jews leaving Egypt is like us sprouting forth. So in Egypt, we were planted like a seed in the ground, and things started to decay. Things started to fall apart. And then once the seed decays in the ground, it starts growing, putting forth the sprouts. And the sprouts come out of the ground and become a great tree. So the Jews are compared to seeds in Egypt. The Gemara actually takes this literally. The Gemara talks about another miracle which happened in Egypt, which the children actually did sprout forth literally from the ground. What does that mean? So the Gemara tells us that, I'll read it to you from the Gemara. It says that the Pharaoh had decreed to kill all the children. So the women who were pregnant, they didn't want to just give birth to a child and have the Egyptians come and kill the child. So what they would do is they would go give birth in the fields under trees. Let's find it for you. Yes, they'd go and give birth under apple trees. And then God would miraculously send, I guess, angels to come and take care of the babies. And then it says that God would provide for them two different foods. They would have a pile of honey, and they would have a jar of oil. Not sure what babies do with oil, but they had a jar of oil. And they would eat this oil and honey to survive, these babies, out in the fields on their own, being taken care of by divine messengers. And when the Egyptians saw this happening, so instead of taking the message that, wow, these are the divine people, they said, let's go kill those babies. So the Egyptians went out to the fields to kill the babies, and a miracle happened, and the babies were swallowed up into the ground. And the Egyptians then came with oxen, and they plowed over the ground to try to kill the babies. So again, the Egyptians did not take the message, wow, these are miracles, you better stop what we're doing and not persecute the Jews. Rather, they tried to kill the babies again. So they tried to plow over the ground to kill these babies, and once the Egyptians left, the babies then popped up out of the ground, sprouted forth from the ground like grass once again. They popped right back up and went back, right back where they were sitting, eating their milk and their, eating their honey and their oil under these apple trees. So that's the miracle that the Gemara describes. And it quotes the same verse, as it says, that I made you as the plants of the field. So there's literally a miracle where babies were cared for as plants of the field. And they were swallowed up in the ground. They sprouted forth from the ground once again. So, which is actually one reason why we put apples into our charoses, because it reminds us of the miracle of the apple trees, because this all happened under apple trees. So we put apples as one of the main ingredients in the charoset in order to remind us of this miracle of the babies being saved under the apple trees. So that's an interesting source for charoset. But so that's the Gemara describes. So we see again there was a miraculous existence even during slavery. They saw these babies, which they gave birth to these babies in the field, and they went back to their houses. The women, they couldn't take the babies back, these would have been killed, and God took care of the babies. And eventually these babies came back to their parents, the rabbis tell us. Eventually the babies got old enough, they actually found their mothers and fathers, went back to their homes, and rejoined the Jewish people. So it's important for us, I think the message for us is that we have to feel at all times, even the most challenging times, there is signs of God which are present for us also in our challenging times. The Jews are in a very challenging stage of growth. When they were in Egypt, the slavery was extremely difficult, the torture was unbearable. But they're experiencing open miracles during this time. I think that's a message we have to take out of it. So we don't experience the same open miracles that they do. But to understand that even when we're in our most challenging times, God is still with us. And we still can see the divine hand even during difficult times of our lives. That's an important message you find in the Haggadah at this point. This verse continues, and we're a little late, but I just want to finish up this same verse over here. It then discusses how they developed. And if you take the Hebrew, the English doesn't do justice to it. If you take the Hebrew says that they reached the age of maturity. When it says that the breasts were firm and the hair grown long, it means that, like a girl reaching an age of maturity. That's what it means. And the idea is that the Jews had reached the age of maturity in Egypt. Now they're now ripe to be redeemed and be taken as God's people. We always view the relationship between God and the Jewish people as a husband-wife relationship. We look at God as the husband, the Jewish people as the wife. The entire book of the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, is a metaphor for that, where God is the man, the Jews are the woman, and it's a love story between a man and a woman. That's the book of Shir HaShirim. And so too, in Egypt is when we were just becoming that beautiful young woman. The Jewish people in Egypt were developing, they're maturing, and the time came, the appropriate time came for redemption. That's described as the girl reaching the age of maturity. At that point, she is mature enough in order to bear children and to provide for babies, to nurse babies. And the idea of nursing a baby is that the Jews are supposed to now become those who are to nurture the world. We're supposed to bring the divine word to the world. Just as a mother provides for a baby, the Jews provide for the world as well. And that's the metaphor being given in this pasuk. As much as we were flourishing, though, the Egyptians tried to destroy us. The very last part where it repeats the same quote twice, it says, I said to you, through your blood you will live. I said to you, through your blood you will live. So it describes this girl. She's mature. She's of childbearing age. She's ready for marriage. But yet, she is naked and bare. She still is, she still needs to be taken care of. And God said, I saw you weltering in your blood. And I said to you, through your blood you will live. Through your blood you will live. So that metaphor is the Jews, even though we were ready to take on God's Torah, we're ready to become God's people. The rabbis tell us we are naked and bare from any merit. At this point, Jews were idolaters. They had sunk in terms of their spiritual stature. And they weren't performing any mitzvahs at the time, technically. Even though they still had maintained their identity, but there wasn't anything they were doing to serve God. They still needed some merit. They were naked of merit. They weren't yet deserving to be redeemed. So God says, I'm going to give you two mitzvahs that have to do with blood in order to give you merit. For your blood you shall live, for your blood you shall live, refers to the blood of Bris Milah. They were to be circumcised in Egypt, and refers to the blood of the Karban Pesach, the Pesach offering. The blood of that sacrifice, and the blood of the Bris Milah, those are two merits given to the Jews in the land of Egypt that enabled them to deserve the redemption. So Moshe commanded them in doing these two mitzvahs. And once they perform these two mitzvahs, and through blood, they're able to be redeemed. So the Karban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, that's the mitzvah which recognizes withdrawing from idolatry and focusing ourselves on the one and only God. And that itself deserves a long explanation, which we don't have time for right now. And this other mitzvah of a bris milah, circumcision, is a Jew's personal connection and covenant with God. That's the covenant. The bris milah is the covenant. So it's withdrawing from idolatry and connecting to God. Those are the two mitzvahs. The blood of the Paschal Lamb is withdrawing from idolatry. And the blood of the Bris Milah is connecting to the covenant with God. Those are the two mitzvahs given to us in the land of Egypt. And with those mitzvahs, you will live. Those are the mitzvahs which enabled us to deserve redemption once they were performed. So the Jews sat there in Egypt. They ate their Paschal Lamb. They put the blood on their doorposts. The men, they underwent Bris Milah. They had a circumcision. And at that point, that was the night where they left Egypt. After they did those two mitzvahs, they were able to leave Egypt. So this is the end of the first section of telling the story. This is the story of the Jews' stature in Egypt, how they lived during in Egypt, the miraculous growth rate, how they got there. We didn't yet discuss the slavery at all. The next section, which God willing we'll look at next week, discusses the slavery and then the actual redemption. That's the next section of the Haggadah. Good question, yeah. Right. So that's a very, very good point, that the Karm Pesach, the laws of the Karm Pesach is you have to eat it in a group. You can't eat it on your own. You have to make groups in Karm Pesach. It's everything about the Karban, which we don't have to discuss now, has to do with unity. Everything seems to come together as one. The fact is roasted whole. Roasting versus, it has to be roasted instead of boiled. If you boil something, usually it falls apart. You roast it, it firms up and comes together and remains as one. Being roasted whole, gathering together in groups. There's a lot of different points about the car. I can't remember them all offhand. No broken bones, right. Everything seems to suggest the idea of unity, of one. So that could be understood that the Jewish people becoming a nation came together as one, and then that led us to the covenant with God of the Bismillah. Also, we mentioned that it symbolizes withdrawing from idolatry, because everything about the Karban Pesach suggests that we're pointing towards the one and only source of it all. It's a Karban which focuses on the idea of unity, and it focuses us on the unity, the one of the world, and the one God of the world. Thank you. All right, so we'll stop here for the week, and God willing, next week we'll try to continue with this section.